We are now heading towards business combinations under common control. See. Okay, Julia, do I give the floor to you?
Yes, thank you very much, Hans. I would like to start with a brief introduction to provide the context for today's discussion, and then I will hand it over to Carla to tee up the paper. So you will remember that earlier this year, we discussed variations of current value approach for business combinations under common control that affect non-controlling interest. And you've directed us to develop an approach that is based on the acquisition method in IFRS 3, but to consider whether and how the acquisition method needs to be modified. So this discussion is coming to a future meeting. However, I would like to note that in principle we think that to the extent that business combinations under common control are similar to regular business combinations, they should be accounted for the same way. And to the extent that they are or may be different, they should be accounted for differently. Also in principle, we think that current value provides the best information about business combinations under common control, which is consistent with the conclusions reached by the board in developing IFRS 3. However, we think that the cost-benefit analysis for business combinations under common control can be different compared to regular business combinations. In addition, if the board wanted to draw some sort of dividing line between types of business combinations under common control, we think that this line needs to be drawn in a way that entities are not able to flip from one side of the line to another, because otherwise that would be effectively retaining accounting choice that we have today, which is what this project is looking to address. That's why we have the discussion about structuring opportunities in the paper. Finally, today's discussion focuses on business combinations under common control that affect NCI. That doesn't mean that we ignore other types of primary users of financial statements. So discussion of transactions between wholly owned entities, including those that affect lenders and creditors, and those that are undertaken in preparation for an IPO, are coming to a future meeting. Also, today's session is educational. We are not asking you to make any decisions. And this is because clearly the question about whether and how to draw any dividing line between types of transactions is closely interrelated with the question of how we account for transactions on the other side of this line. Therefore, we plan to later ask you about decisions on a package. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Carla to tee up today's paper.
Thanks, Julia. And good morning, board members. So the purpose of this session is to discuss whether current value approach based on acquisition method in IFRS 3 should be applied to all BCUCC transactions when NCI in the receiving entity is affected, and if not all, how that distinction could be made. In principle, we observe that information needs of NCI are the same regardless of their size or nature, and regardless whether they have access to information other than through the receiving entity's financial statements. However, cost-benefit analysis can be different in different cases. For example, consider a scenario where there is 45% public NCI in the receiving entity, and a scenario where NCI is represented only by few employee stock options. So although information needs will always be the same, the benefits of providing current value information may not always justify the cost. We also noted that there's no perfect approach, applying current value approach either to all or only some BCUCC transactions affecting NCI, both have their own advantages and disadvantages. We observe that applying current value approach for all transactions have the following advantages. It would provide the most useful information to the NCI in all cases. It is a simple approach. It would prevent entities from structuring transactions by changing the size or nature of the NCI. And using acquisition method as a basis, provides a familiar foundation that is already described in IFRS, applied in practice, and understood. On the other hand, we identified certain disadvantages in applying current value approach to all BCUCC transactions affecting NCI. Arguably, it would not take into account cost constraint. So remember the example of 45% NCI versus NCI represented by few stock options. In addition, although it would prevent structuring transactions by changing the size or nature of the NCI, it could allow restructuring by simply creating an NCI. And finally, it does not take into account the fact that some NCI may have access to information and does not solely rely on the receiving entity's general purpose financial statements. For example, consider public NCI versus NCI held by key management personnel in a receiving entity. On that basis, we think requiring current value approach to only some cases is a better approach. That brings us to the next question. How do we make a distinction between transactions when we do and do not require current value approach? In abstract, this could be done through a qualitative approach, a quantitative approach, or a combination of the two. Under qualitative approach, the distinction could be made when the receiving entity's equity instruments are publicly traded. Alternatively, a distinction could be based on the type of the NCI, whether the NCI is held by the related parties or employees of the receiving entity or controlling party. Under a quantitative approach, the distinction would be made based on whether the size of the NCI meets a particular threshold. Under a combination of qualitative and quantitative approaches, the distinction could be made based on whether the NCI exhibits particular qualitative or quantitative characteristics or both. Again, we'd like to emphasize that no approach is perfect in all respects. However, and on balance, we think that that making a distinction based on whether the receiving entity's equity instruments are publicly traded is a viable approach to explore. This is because such a distinction provides the most useful information for NCI in public entities. It is arguably least open to structuring opportunities. It builds on approaches described in our existing IFRS literature, specifically IAS 33 and IFRS 8. And it could be extended to scenarios where the transactions affects lenders and other creditors rather than NCI. And finally, it is clear and a simple approach to apply. However, we understand that a considerable main disadvantage of this approach is that it would not result in current value information being provided to private NCI. To address that and to also address cost constraint, a quantitative threshold could be introduced for private NCI. However, we think that a quantitative threshold would create structuring opportunities in private NCI scenarios. Before we open the floor for discussion, we'd like to share also the feedback we received on the paper at last week's ASAF meeting. Most ASAF members seem to agree with using current value approach whenever NCI is present in a public receiving entity. Most seem to believe that the current value approach should also be used in at least some private NCI scenario, and noted that making a distinction would always be difficult. A few ASAF members did not agree with looking at the information needs of various primary users as the starting point in the analysis. Instead, those members suggested considering, for example, whether the transaction has commercial substance. Some suggested that instead of making a distinction, allow the NCI to decide whether they need current value information, which is similar to the exemption from producing consolidated information in IFRS 10, or even giving management the choice to choose the accounting treatment. One member disagreed with the use of current value accounting to all BCUCC. And finally, some ASAF members questioned the focus on structuring opportunities. Some others expressed a view that regardless of the approach taken, it should not allow creation of values artificially. And with that, we open the floor for discussion.
Errol? Carlo, just on that description from the ASAF, because I'd also had this curiosity about IFRS 10 scoping paragraph, which allows you to insert if all shareholders agree, not to perform a consolidation. And I just wondered if you had considered that as part of the process that you'd gone through in coming to the decision, because it seems like that would be quite a useful solution, and that the smaller the shareholder group, and particularly if the shareholder group is an internal management or something like that, there's a strong likelihood that you would be able to achieve that. But even for a private company, if you've got a widespread of external NCI, it's going to be a lot harder to achieve it. And it seems like, I'm not sure if we've heard how that test works in practice.
I think it's fair to say that it wasn't discussed in a great depth of detail by the ASAP, so that idea was aided by a couple of members. One ASAP member expressed a view that making this approach practicable would be quite difficult, and I think there was a view that maybe instead of requiring all NCI to agree, there could be sort of a different approach, nearly all or something like that. I don't remember the specific words, but this is a new idea that came up at the ASAP meeting. And arguably, if the board wanted to capture some of the private NCI scenarios, this could potentially be used for those private NCI scenarios. Arguably, it would be more difficult to use this approach for public companies where you have a large scope of dispersed public shareholders.
I think I would probably seen that this type of solution would have meant that almost certainly public entities would have to apply the acquisition approach, which is in line, I think, with your recommendation, but that there would also be certain circumstances in which private entities would have to do it. Now, there is an overlap with the two, because I suspect that if you are able to get agreement from your NCI that you don't have to do this, you probably also have agreement with them that you don't have to prepare consolidated accounts in the first place. So it's probably quite a small group where this is likely to pop out. But it just seemed like that was a useful avenue to explore.
Yeah. Yeah, Chao?
Yes. First, just with regard to ASAP discussion, I think some ASAP member also mentioned the NCI protection mechanism in some jurisdiction they are in place. So actually, those NCI can get access to the relevant information, regardless what kind of accounting treatment in place. So I think some of the ASAP members did mention that. I think this kind of message we should consider when we explore further. With regard to the paper, first, I appreciate the staff's research and analysis. It was a very good paper. It is a very good paper, and the staff tried to consider various factors, including the cost strengths and access to information, structuring opportunities, all those factors, and decide what kind of accounting treatment we should have for the BCUCC involving NCI. So I appreciate the paper. However, I still have some questions. I think we should explore further. First is that currently, we are using an approach so-called actually drawing a line approach. We try to join a line, you know, in which cases should using, you know, current value method, current value approach, in which cases which maybe the entities can using precision method, something like that. But I'm thinking that it may result in some kind of rule-based approach. We try to develop some kind of, as you said, that qualitative or quantitative approach, then will result in some kind of rule-based approach. And then, as you said, that in paragraph 47 said that it will provide structure opportunity for the entities to work around those lines. So I still prefer whether it's possible to develop a principle-based approach to apply to apply those principles for the various, you know, CUCCs. So this is the first question I ask. And the second question is that I'm always thinking about that whether the nature of the BCUCC will change because the receiving entity is a public entity or private entity, or because the share of the NCI maybe is large or small or whatever, you know, or these kind of factors. I think the nature of the business, the transaction most likely should not be changed. Very simple, as I say, If there is a table, is the table owned by the private entity or the table owned by the public entity, I think the accounting treatment should be the same because of the nature of the table, not changing. So I think, I think some ASF members also mentioned we should look at the nature of the BCUCC, not only look at the information needs of the users, but also should look at the commercial substance and the nature of the BCUCC. And this is, I think, the accounting should do, try to faithfully represent the nature of the transaction. And the third question I would like to ask is that, actually, by now, I'm still not very convinced that what the information needs of the NCI and whether the NCI can get access to those information or not. So I would like to encourage the staff to explore further whether there are special information needs arising from NCI and whether their information could be accessible or not. And finally, with regard to the staff's recommendation about the approach that the combination of qualitative and quantitative approach, I'm thinking about that this approach may well create new complexity and new cost, not only for the preparers, also for the users to understand the combination approach.
May I respond?
Yes, Julia. Yeah.
Thank you, Hans. So I maybe start with your first question and go through your questions one by one. So first of all, your point about drawing the line and creating a principle-based approach as opposed to rule-based approach. I think it's important to understand that unless the board requires the acquisition method for all business combinations, regular business combinations and business combinations under common control, we will have a dividing line. The only question is where this dividing line lies. Secondly, with respect to the nature of business combinations under common control, I completely agree with you that the nature of business combinations under common control does not depend on whether there is public NCI or private NCI or whether the transaction is between wholly owned entities. However, information needs about those transactions will be different compared who primary users are. So if we only have the controlling party, then the controlling party will already have access to information or should have access to information that they need. In contrast, if you have a public entity and public non-controlling shareholders, they will need transparent information about that transaction to understand how it is going to affect the reporting entity and how it's going to affect their interest in that reporting entity. I suppose with respect to complexity, your complexity point, again, partly it takes me back to the question of drawing the line. So again, unless we require the acquisition method for all business combinations and all business combinations under common control, we will have complexity associated with making a distinction. And also, perhaps maybe to help a little bit with this complexity point, today, in practice, entities already apply both the acquisition method and the predecessor method. So again, it's all the question of where we draw the line as opposed to creating something new altogether. And the only other point I wanted to make is going back to your point about ASAF discussion about access to information and NCI protection. I think we need to be very careful to distinguish three different considerations. So first of all, in some jurisdictions, there can indeed be some sort of protection of NCI, whereas in other jurisdictions, that protection may not exist. But this project is about providing information about transactions. It's not about creating or eliminating any sort of protections that already exists in legislation. So I think protection of NCI and information to NCI are completely two different points. And finally, this is also different from the question of do they already have access to information. If we have NCI represented by the members of key management personnel, they would still need current value information to understand the transaction, but they may already have access to information, whereas public shareholders would not. So I think that probably addresses all the points that you raised.
Sue?
What I found perhaps most as interesting as the comments on the preferred approaches in the ASAP meeting was the discussion that we got into a little bit from the different members about trying to understand why it was we were focusing on the non-controlling interests. So there seemed to be some who thought that the reason why we were focusing on non-controlling interests was somehow we thought we needed to police the type of deals and make sure people were doing good transactions, that it was some sort of almost public policy type of role, which I don't think is the case. Some asked whether it was because we thought it was necessary to better understand future cash flows and questioned whether that was always the case because they were questioning acquisition accounting. For me, when I look at it simplistically, I think it's to help non-controlling interests who may not otherwise have direct access to the information understand whether or not they still want to be an investor in that entity given what's going on. So it's sort of a way of making sure that the people who need information because they can't get it somewhere else can get it to make those hold or buy investment decisions. So it's to give them information. But it did strike me in that discussion that perhaps it means we need to be a bit more, spend a bit more time articulating why it is we're focusing on the non-controlling interest, because I think it might be important for people when they're then giving us feedback on whether or not they like the cut that we've drawn, because I agree with you that the information needs, in my mind, are different for different parties. And I actually quite like the analysis that you have done and your approach here, because I think it's maybe a practical way of trying to target the people who are more likely to need the information than others. But I think having that background so people can comment on that and think about that and see whether, firstly, they agree with that sort of logic, but secondly, whether they think the approach we take achieves that outcome would be a useful addition. And the other thing I think that, a couple of things that were discussed in that meeting and I thought about when I was reading the paper were, personally, I think we're overdoing a little bit the anti-avoidance aspects. And while we can't be blind to those, I don't think we should be talking about that or making that drive our thinking too much in any of our standard setting, including this. So I sort of agree with where you get, but I wouldn't put so much emphasis on that. Mm-hmm. I actually thought the IFRS 10 idea was quite a nice way of maybe also in a different way trying to ask the same question. Do we have people who need this information? Let's ask them if they need it or not, particularly because it's one way of getting a cost-benefit cut because I once indirectly paying the cost of getting the information. So I think it's worth having a think about. One other point was, I'm pleased that you weren't going down a sort of substance route in here because I don't know what substance means. And often when people talk about where they think there's substance or not in these transactions, I'd reach a different conclusion. So it worries me because I'm not sure it's a very clear concept to use. So I'm pleased you're not using that. Thank you.
Mary?
I apologize because I feel that I'm maybe not quite caught up with this project or thinking about it slightly differently. Because I stand back and say, what's different about business combinations under common control from regular BizCom, which is, you know, I think where the staff started out when you came up with the starting point of the, you know, IFRS 3 acquisition method. And to me, the key difference is the last three words, they're under common control. And so what does that raise? And to me, it says, one, I want to look at this transaction and see if there's, if the related party nature, you know, the common control, has impacted the terms. Doesn't mean I want to set them perfectly to what it would be if it were an open market, because I think that's impossible. You know, these are one-off transactions in the sense of being individually tailored versus standard, you know, standard market transactions. But it makes me say, one, is there any capital transaction, a capital contribution or capital distribution, you know, implicit in the terms? I'm buying something very cheap that is in effect a capital contribution to me, or I'm selling something for way above, you know, its value, in which case I'm in effect making a distribution to, you know, maybe via the seller to, you know, to the common control entity, because I'm moving things around within the group. So to me, that's a fundamental question when I have a BC under common control as opposed to one between arm's length parties. Mm-hmm. And then the when I think about that possibility, I'd say my first question is assess the transaction to to determine whether the terms indicate that there is a capital transaction incorporated into the transaction, and if so, separate it out and account for it. And I'm going to distinguish doing that from saying you must account for every transaction at its, you know, its fair value, which I think is some of what we were exploring with the headroom mechanics, the, you know, the different approaches. I think it's a screening test that may be imprecise and high level, but that's question one I'd want to ask. And then the other kind of anchor I have when I think about these transactions is I want the entity that's receiving the business, the acquirer, to account for what it has paid based on the current value of what it is paying. And because I think in terms of reflecting the transactions that the reporting entity has engaged in the period, accounting for what it is paying rather than, you know, to, is what's necessary to faithfully represent the transaction in which it has engaged. Now, if it is paying in items carried at historical cost that have appreciated significantly, presumably they couldn't have depreciated without an impairment being recognized, that has appreciated significantly, I would expect that to be reflected in the fair value of what they are receiving. And I think those would be weird and one-off transactions, and we should be looking to filter those out and get the right accounting. If it's a, I'm doing a group restructuring to simplify the transaction, I'm not trying to do, you know, to do anything else. Maybe it's payment in shares, maybe it's not. But I think the two filters for me, before I start getting into is there NCI, is there not, et cetera, are is there a capital transaction that I have to, that I should be identifying and reflecting? And, it, you know, shouldn't I be accounting for the consideration paid at its current value? And then with those two thoughts in mind, I have to say I struggle a bit with trying to, I agree with you, Yulia, that if we're going to do anything other than IFRS 3 for all, there's going to have to be a dividing line, and we have to think about where that dividing line is. Mm-hmm. I struggle with so much focus being on NCI because I go back to the point you acknowledged about we haven't yet considered other primary users. But if we go down a path that's based on the presence of NCI or not, I think it's either wasted effort or it's going to be very hard to backtrack from that if we are then going to alter it because of the information needs of potential investors or lenders or other creditors and sweep in more things. So I don't know why we'd invest so much in trying to define the NCI dividing line as a first step if we're then going to possibly unpick it when we consider the information needs of other users of financial statements. And I think that the two things that I find myself most wanting to know about BizCom, because they're under common control, the capital transactions and you know, what's the fair value of the consideration paid, are equally relevant to all stakeholders. And I think if I could solve those two answer those two questions, I then could think about what, if any, simplifications I could do for IFRS 3/current, you know, current value accounting to address the cost-benefit consideration, which I think is a valid concern when we're dealing with BizCom under common controls. So that's not really very responsive to the specific questions that you're setting out in the paper, but they're the things that are my highest concerns when I look at this category of transaction, and I think relate to the nature of the transactions. And I don't know what you do with that.
Maybe if I respond very quickly, and I was sort of trying to presuppose such comments in my little introduction, but just to reassure everyone that all those questions are coming to the board. So we first started looking at transaction in terms of what sort of current value method we use. And then we looked at, okay, what are the information needs of primary users? So we sort of need to sequence the topics, and then eventually we will need to bring it all together. But just to reassure you, Mary, and everyone, that the question about, well, is there a capital contribution or distribution element in the transaction? Yes, this question is high on our list, and this question is coming back. And we think it is sort of important to first discuss various aspects, primary users, how current value method could be applied, and then make decision on a package of the topics rather than each individual topic. That's our plan.
Gary?
Thank you. And to begin, I thought this was a very well-written paper by the staff, and I think it's the first paper in months on BCUCC that didn't have lots of circles and arrows and charts in it. I was looking for them, didn't see them. It just a few reactions, and let me temper these, going back to former career, my whole career following a life cycle of an NCI ranging from zero with 30% public float and back to effectively zero. It with perhaps in today's values, $1 billion plus in the NCI bucket. I think, first of all, I think perhaps there is no perfect solution to this. I think we just need to accept that. We can't let the great be the enemy of the good, and we should probably face reality is that we can only take this so far and make a big improvement, but the law of diminishing returns to make a great improvement is going to probably be working against us. I think, on balance, I think actually a qualitative approach should be the lead way of doing it, and quantitative perhaps be in supplemental proof point or something like that. But so I think quantitative, if that's the lead, you can be structured around. And also, it changes over time, too. It, you know, like in my example, from 0 to 30% to 0% over about a 25-year arc, at what point is it inconsequential? At what point are all the true public holders gone? It's just insiders that are left, and so on. So if you went to quantitative, you'd have to be in time, if not up front, have to address questions like that. And I think that's, again, perhaps law diminishing returns in coming into play. It'll be obvious when you should. The question is, when shouldn't you? And that will be, yeah, I think, reasonable people can reasonably differ. I think the suggestion to start with where you have equity instruments that are in public market is the right place to start. I think, and again, I think being in a public market and the example I was thinking of, and I can take you offline on it, at some point, yes, you're nominally in a public market. Yes, you are listed on a major stock exchange, but ultimately you're very thinly traded because most of the shares are in, you know, thinly traded securities departments of major banks. And in fact, when you're trying to, my experience was you're trying to get them down to zero, one of the global money center banks we've all heard of had them, and it took 3 months just to find what department these things were parked in, because in the thinly traded securities department that no one even knew was there, because there were foreign securities, and so on. So those are just the practical things, I think. So I agree, public approach, public market approach is right, but again, it's going to have some limits in there. And I think the other, you know, I guess objective, you know, to borrow from primary financial statements and disclosure initiative, their objective should be when, if a sizable portion of the NCI cannot get the insider information on their own, might be one of those qualitative tests. If it's all substantially employees or the controlling and management or the founding family at that are related parties, if not active, they've got abilities to get information. And I think if that's the great preponderance of the NCI, I'm not so sure this is all that necessary for them. We can test, I'm not against it, but I'm not so sure they actually need that information either. I could go on at some length, but I think I'll stop at that. I do think if we solved it for NCI, I think that's the primary user group with the most needs. Then you get convertible securities and other things. I think the public debt, I think they progressively have lesser and lesser needs than equity holders, because ultimately they're the residual and they get, you know, what's left of the company.
Martin?
Yeah, and I'm struggling a little bit because before we have found a solution on the issues we discussed in the prior meetings, which was, okay, if it is not an arm's length transaction, what we should do then with fair value and then doing all this kind of thing. So applying really the acquisition method in scenarios where we don't think it is an arm's length transaction, I think we have not finally decided on, okay, what kind of approach we would prefer and what not prefer. And then to saying, okay, but if we don't have decided on that, then okay, we should maybe for public, we should use this method or not. I think for me it is difficult because when I, a little bit like Mary, I think what is the information needs of an NCI in this kind of transaction? I would think first it is okay, information need, is it an arm's length transaction or wasn't it not an arm's length transaction? And I don't know if acquisition method applying yes or no would help this kind of information needs. And even if it was not an arm's length transaction, I think then to apply the acquisition method could lead to a misleading maybe result, because maybe then I have goodwill which is not substantive or whatever kind of thing. So I think it is difficult to answer that question without having a clear solution, okay, what we do with the acquisition methods in scenarios where we think, okay, it is not at fair value. Because I think also, and I said it already earlier, but then to require all the kind of entities to ask them to come up with a fair value calculation in a related party transaction is also not so helpful, because we all know that it is not so objective measurable. And therefore, my comments are not so helpful, but I think it is difficult to, when it's not a decision paper, I understand that today, but to maybe provide comments on the direction without having a solution for, I think, the overall project. But as you said, Julia, I think we will discuss all that together, and I think we need. And if we would find a solution for that first problem, I think maybe the public entity is a good direction, but I'm not sure if we can find a good solution on the first thing. And I think also, and I want to say that I think we need some discussion at some point in time, okay, what the predecessor method really kind of information provides to people, because I have never looked at that kind of method, because maybe others have done more from the S region, but I have never, and I cannot compare, okay, what is the information, is it so maybe less than if I would use an acquisition method?
Just one little, I probably should remind the board again that you've already made decision that we will use acquisition method for transactions that affect NCI as a basis. So that decision has already been made.
It was a tentative decision.
Yes.
I agree.
All our decisions.
Yeah. We didn't say we would necessarily end up there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anne? Thanks, Anne. One of the other things that came out in ASAF was a comment that we've heard in other fora as well, and that's the business of we don't have to worry about NCI because they've got protections. Certain markets give them protections. So I just wanted to bring that up. I don't think that it will particularly guide us. I think we have to do our work, and I don't think we can rely on inconsistent protections of different types in securities markets. So I do think we have to address this NCI issue. I think the paper is very helpful in getting us thinking along those lines. It would be nice to be principle-based. It would be nice to avoid a bright line, but I agree with Julia. I don't see how we're going to be able to do that.
Daryl?
So I'm a little bit concerned that we've got two distinct streams of discussion happening here, and they seem to feed right back to why we think we're doing the project in the first place. My starting point is to think that the NCI investor is an investor like anybody else. They invested at, I think we had the parent A and B. They're investing in the A level, and all they care about is the A level and below. And my starting point is to say, well, why should they get any different accounting to anybody else in any type of company? So if we think that acquisition approach is providing the best information for any entity acquiring another entity in terms of making, to Sue's point, the investment decisions and the like, then why should we think that it should be different for an independent investor into A? I agree with Mary and with Mark's point that there is some information content in overpaying or underpaying. But at the end of the day, my starting point is to say, why should they get any different information? They are an investor in their own right. And if I start with that philosophy,
then I say the acquisition method is the right method because it's the method that any other investor in an entity that has acquired something is seeing in the financial statements. And then I say, and this comes a little bit to Anne's point, that what we're then discussing is to what extent do we believe we should be giving cost-benefit relief to entities in certain circumstances. So my starting philosophy, acquisition method, from that deviation, when I move away from that, I start saying, all right, are there specific circumstances in which I believe cost-benefit relief is acceptable? 100% owned entity with no external credit providers is one easy example to think of cost relief. I think the discussion you've got in the paper gives us a nice thought process for saying that we can provide in other circumstances. I thought it was a good paper. I agree with others who said that. But I think we need to be thinking about this as the exception we are creating is for certain categories of NCI, for example, the private investors, not the exception we are creating is by making some entities actually provide acquisition accounting. And I just think this philosophical thing is really important because I think if we start thinking about this as we are making people do things, I think what we're doing is we're relieving them from having to do things that they otherwise would have done. And I think that is an important consideration.
If I might just have one observation, I completely agree, Daryl, with how you think about it. And this is how we generally think about that as well. But there is another consideration, I think, here, which relates to the fact that the acquisition method in IFRS 3, it relies on the fact that the transaction takes place on fair terms, that it's sort of fair value of the consideration represents fair value of what you acquired. And it is that assumption which makes the whole acquisition method work. So, and if we look at business combinations under common control, you can have circumstances where consideration is not representative of what is acquired, and you do have a component of capital contribution, capital distributions, in which case, in some shape or form, arguably, it would be useful to screen for those components, which is going back to Mary's and Martin's point. But the question is how exactly...
Absolutely. But that's facilitating people better applying the acquisition method, I think, rather than saying they shouldn't be applying the acquisition method at all. Yeah. It's providing guidance to better understand how to do that.
Françoise?
Well, in principle, I would want to exclude nobody. And similarly to what Sue said, I think every investor should have its rights accommodated. And so I don't believe really in a quantitative threshold at all. Also, I would like to mention that the smaller your interest in the company, the less likely you are in being able to access to information that you're not granted. Also, like Sue, I was attracted to the suggestion by ASAF, some ASAF members, that the exemption could be granted by the investors themselves. I'm not giving a clear-cut answer, but it's an educational session, so little bits and pieces can help. If I would contemplate having a category of investors separated out, I would consider the related parties. I think in considering all this, where we would not go for the current value approach, however it is articulated, acquisition method or acquisition method with some alterations, I would want also to consider the disclosures that can accompany the other method when it is applied, because they may, especially for a smaller investor, eventually accommodate some needs. And I also considered that, you know, there was not so much pressure from my perspective on reaching a preliminary. I know reaching preliminary views is helpful, so I'm not suggesting that we don't go there. But to me, what is important is that the full discussion that you have brought into this paper is reproduced and eventually amended, but reproduced in a discussion paper, because all these elements, I think, are worthwhile considering outside our own group. And finally, there were two comments that were made at ASAF that I would like to react upon. The first one was those members that suggested that the substance should have a role to play. And I agree that with the remark that you made in that meeting that for the entity that we are considering, there is always a substance. So to me, it cannot be any anchor. Also, it's not because a transaction would be initiated for tax reasons, so having a tax benefit in mind, that it means that there would not be, it would not be made at the detriment of some NCI. So to me, this is absolutely not a route. But I also agree with the comment that has been made at ASAF, is that the acquisition method out of itself is not a protection. With that, I think I have mentioned the elements of thinking that your paper has stimulated.
Nick?
Thank you. Just to pick up on various comments we made. Firstly, I really doubt whether we can provide information or whether the audit profession can provide information to show whether transactions actually been done at arm's length or not. I think it's for us to provide the information to the market, to you to make that determination. I just don't think we're in the position to provide that. I can't see how we possibly could. So I think it's about that provision of shareholders. I think it's right to focus on the NCIs to begin with. There are other users we need to think of. Some of those will have privileged access to information anyway, but we need to come back and consider that. I think it's important to focus initially on the NCI. I see it's part of the shareholder protection package that they would get this information. I have a very strong preference for qualitative criteria over quantitative criteria here, and I'd also be wary of putting too much emphasis on potential structuring opportunities. I think we can make less of that. I also think, well, my last point is I think it's important that entities will account for these transactions in a consistent manner and not reflecting the nature of individual transactions. I think it will be exceptionally confusing to see one transaction accounted for using predecessor amounts and the next one accounted using current values. I think that will, most users won't be able to cope with that approach. So.
Doug?
Thank you. I basically agree with the direction staff is approaching, and but that is only the case when we really need to make the distinction between NCI's transaction and other transactions. The question is, of course, if there is an NCI, maybe we need to do the current value approach, and then the we need dividing line, but the in the future discussion, we have to consider the information needs for potential investors. From the viewpoint of potential investors, if there is a big difference between the transaction with the NCI and the transaction without the NCI, then the potential investor might be misled, because the outcome of the business combination itself is completely different. And the other concern is, just Nick pointed out, in one group, some transaction is used predecessor method, and some transaction used for
current value method approach would confuse users. But it could happen because NCI could leave at any time. So when there is no NCI, you use predecessor method. And then all of a sudden NCI came, then you use current value approach. And then NCI left, then next one would use a predecessor approach. That will entirely confuse the shape of the financial statement. So therefore, the biggest question we definitely need to answer is whether or not we should draw the dividing line.
Tom?
Just a couple of comments. First, I guess a note. I think I agree that employees are different than public, but I'd also, within employees, there are some organizations that go very deep in various shares and options and others that are in the management group. The ones that go deep, it's not as obvious those people have access to very much. I don't know that it'd be enough to make a distinction, but I don't think we should always assume employees have access. There was sort of an interesting thing going on, and I like the way Daryl described. I just want to review it again and then sort of set up, is there an alternate approach? I like Daryl's, that if you have investors, you should basically provide them with the best accounting. I got it right, and the best accounting we think is the way the acquisition approach works. And that would also sort of satisfy Mary's question. For example, if they had publicly traded debt, I presume that would fall into investors and we'd get an answer. So I like that. So I was just thinking about it. So then, when is there an argument for the alternative, the predecessor method? That, you know, what would that argument be? Because I basically buy Daryl's. And I was sort of thinking that the arguments, at least I've heard from people, is that, first of all, it's cheaper, I guess. But there were two arguments, I think, that might have some validity. One is that predecessor precludes structuring, in that if I own two subsidiaries, I can tell A to buy B or B to buy A, and I can get, in other words, one set of assets will move at current value. I get to choose, and I make a decision. So if we're worried about, structuring is not quite the right word. The question is, which set of assets get revalued? I can do A's or I can do B's. And so if we say that you have to use fair values when you transfer them over, I can still kind of maneuver what the result is, because I can choose which does which. And the other point that was made is, looking down at future investors, once you have this entity put together, the argument I've heard is that to the degree that it's a bit arbitrary and it may not go across the actual consideration transferred, may not be at fair value, you're fundamentally putting these two things together because you're going to ultimately sell, you're going to issue debt on it or you're going to sell stuff. And that by putting it together at predecessor, you've got continuity of the accounting and you've got trends are more visible because, again, it's a bit arbitrary whether A takes B or B takes A. And so we preserve the continuity across the sum of the two. So those were the arguments. And I don't know if it's worth, but when I try and think, because I'm inclined to go where Daryl went, but I want to think also about what would be the counter argument for people who really want predecessor. Those are the two, I think, that come in, that if you are going to sell this unit, you may actually get better information by not sort of taking one set of the assets and revaluing them. In other words, only whatever, assume they're equal size, you're only going to take half the assets and revalue, and the entity chooses which half. Or would you leave them all the same and you get at least some consistency? Anyway, I'm not sure what the answer is, but I just thought I'd kind of put that out.
Can I just make one quick observation with the structuring related to the use of predecessor method? I think we need to remember that if we apply the acquisition method set out in IFRS 3, it's not so much about who nominally bought who. You would need to look you would need to assess who is the accounting acquirer as opposed to legal acquirer. So it's not necessarily a free choice how you move entities across.
No, no, I would agree in three, but if I really control the two, that's the whole point. And if it's a public entity, you have to figure out who's acquiring who, and it has to have economic substance. The choice, if I own two things, of who does who is totally at my whim, then it is a different world than that public world.
No, no, but still, even in internal transaction, even if entity A acquires entity B, if we were to apply the acquisition method to that transaction, it doesn't necessarily mean that entity A would be identified as an accounting acquirer.
Same problem, though. I still choose one of the two.
Well, it's not a choice. There are objective criteria. Who is the accounting acquirer? So basically, I'm disagreeing with the statement that predecessor method prevents structuring because the choice of accounting, well, because the identification of accounting acquirer is not a free choice in IFRS 3.
It's conceivable you'd get a case, but I think in general it would be fairly easy to still have the parent and get it passed as this is the acquirer. I don't think that would be enough on this type of structuring. And I think that was cited actually in the U.S. when they did it with their thing for private, was they cited that as a concern.
Changwu?
Thank you. Some stakeholders suggested that we need to see first the nature of BC-UCC, as Jinzhao pointed out in the beginning, and some others. These people are suggesting the BC-UCC is not business combination at all. It looks like a kind of a restructuring or reorganization. So they think this kind of a transaction is quite different. So Jinzhao suggest an example, a table. This table is not a business combination. So this table is totally different thing. So before giving some kind of information to some people, NCR, any kind of people, who can't have access to the information, anybody can. So we can provide some kind of information on this nature, on the economics of the transaction. If this is a table, it's a kind of reorganized some kind of activity, we should tell them this is a table, not a business combination. So if there is a kind of round table on a different thing, if this is a kind of real business combination, then we should tell them this is a business combination. So I understood when some stakeholders suggested to us we need to think about the nature of business combination. I guess that's what Jinzhao told us. You know, the nature of business combination might not be some kind of normal business combination. So if that's the case, we should provide a totally different information. So in a sense, if it's difficult to recognize something, for example, the Goodyear or something, under this kind of a difficult situation, then we might think another alternative way to communicate to our stakeholders, maybe no disclosure. If they need some kind of information on this kind of a transaction that looks like maybe reorganization, restructuring of that organization without recognizing any goodwill, we can provide some kind of information, the note. So that's maybe another way to think about this difficult subject, even though we have done a very good job, but there are many, many, many stakeholders outside who have different views on this project. That's why the one thing is the nature of that transaction.
And Joe?
Just because we are focused on the information needs of NCI, so I'm thinking that whether staff can explore further what kind of information they need. Based on my experience, as I think those NCI, receiving entities, they always, if the receiving entity have BCUCC, they always look at that transaction differently with those normal business combination. as Mary mentioned, that the difference because this transaction on the common control. And there we think that the control continue, business continue, especially if BCUCC is group restructuring, they don't think that substantial changes happened. So I would like to encourage you to reach out those NCI, exactly those investors, what kind of information they really like. And also, if we're going to that ask the receiving entity to provide current value information, so that means the assets received, the liability received will be measured at fair value, and also the goodwill will be recognized. So whether those NCI will make adjustment of those depreciation and amortization based on the current value, and also the goodwill, because this is simply because the BCUCC, they don't think those assets should be evaluated and the goodwill should be recognized. Yeah, so we need some evidence to explore further what kind of approach we should have. Yeah, when we develop the criteria, the guidance.
Okay. Was the staff helped by this discussion? Do you have a clear sense of direction?
Okay. I would say yes.
Let's take a break till 1:30.